why the Christian church is not pacifist. This is not like a canned talk that I do. This is one that was prompted more or less by the occasion to come and speak with you guys here. The title merits some explanation. Very interesting for me to be here at Duke University talking about why Christianity is not a pacifist, you know, generally speaking, church or group of churches. Because as all of you know, right, this is the place where Stanley Hauer was taught for, you know, over a quarter of a century, that Christian churches ought to be pacifist or they're apostatizing. I, at Notre Dame, studying under Stanley's mentor, John Howard Yoder. Yoder and I were, in close dialogue over these kinds of questions. I come out of course, the Catholic faith. It's a serious question for us as well. But the question itself was prompted by an essay that Hauerwas and Yoder are themselves responding to. In 1940, Reinhold Niebuhr writes this essay by the same title, Why the Christian Church is Not Pacifist, responding to certain trends at the time in the 1940s during the war, concerned about the Christian posture towards killing in war. You may know that, or some of you will know, I hope everybody knows who Reinhold Niebuhr was. Maybe I shouldn't have assumed that. Reinhold Niebuhr was a very prominent Protestant, or evangelisch, essentially, Protestant minister who came out of Detroit, where he had spent most of his early career arguing against Henry Ford and criticizing Henry Ford. He was associated with certain socialist movements in the early part of the 1900s. Against the trend of capitalism in the country, but then he moderates as he thinks the country moderates its capitalism, and becomes a prominent Protestant minister concerned with certain kinds of social issues, but a real advocate of what will be called by some a response to liberal Protestantism. Liberal Protestantism, or liberal theology, is not liberal in the sense that we think of it, right? I'm not using the term in the contemporary sense of liberal. For a liberal theology and liberal Protestantism, there are certain kinds of presuppositions that they all shared. Presuppositions about the perfectibility of the human being, presuppositions about the perfectibility of society. These were things that Reinhold Niebuhr rejected. He thought that liberal Protestantism or liberal theology was way too optimistic about the possibilities of human perfection and social perfection, and needed to have a deeper understanding of sin. So he writes this essay responding to liberal Protestant thought at the time, saying that, in fact, because of the fact of sin in the world, because we can't expect a kind of unilinear progress of man through history, but instead should anticipate there's going to be conflict and violence, the Christian churches had rightly committed themselves to the use of force in defense of other peoples when necessary. That's what you do in a sinful society. Niebuhr's response to liberal theology was itself criticized, as you know, by Hauerwas, in other words, as another version of liberal political theology. In particular, Yoder and Hauerwas were two of the main, Hauerwas remains two of the main critics of that version of liberal Protestantism. They think Niebuhr himself is trapped in liberal theological ways of seeing the world, and Stanley and John Howard, right, were opposing that. To some extent, I don't have much stake in that view, right, as a Catholic theologian. However, because of the way things have changed, right, in the United States, there's really been an ecumenical dialogue among Protestants and Catholics. I was taught at Notre Dame by a leading Protestant representative of a pacifistic tradition. I was taught also by Catholics. That view, right, that view that Stanley and John Howard advocated for became influential on Catholic thought too. And you can see appearances of it in different places, like, for instance, the U.S. Bishop's document on peace, right? The challenge of peace that comes out in 1983, I think it is. Yeah, it is 83. That document quotes, among other people, James Childress, who was a Protestant or a Quaker professor of ethics at the University of Virginia. Right, so there's a lot of like sort of exchange of ideas. This idea, even though I said I don't have much stake in it, has become influential on Catholic theology. So I do have to deal with it. So why might we think, right, that churches ought to be pacifist? Well, John Howard and Stanley would say, look at Scripture. Look in particular at the New Testament. There seems to be some deep scriptural warrant for thinking that those people who call themselves disciples of Jesus Christ ought to embrace nonviolence. Jesus does not appear to embrace violence. He does not appear to use violence in defense of certain claims he wants to make, right? He seems instead to embrace a kind of nonviolent posture. I've quoted the Sermon on the Mount, right? This is Matthew 5, verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God, right? That's a kind of classic text that advances the conception there's an incompatibility between being a peacemaker and being somebody who is going to use force, even force for good purposes. Jesus seems to be advocating for nonviolence. Here's Matthew a little bit later, right? The Gospel of Matthew, just a few verses later, where Jesus deepens the Old Testament commandment against murder, right? It's not even just we shouldn't murder, you shouldn't even bear hatred towards those who are your enemies, right? So if you thought that I came to abolish the old law, wrong. In fact, I'm deepening it. So it's not merely don't murder, right? Don't even harbor in your heart hatred for those who are aligned against you. This would seem to cut, to push us towards a kind of nonviolent posture. And then St. Paul, as a good disciple of Christ, right, the apostle, he seems to extend this. Live peaceably with all men, right, without distinction. So there's scriptural warrant for this view that perhaps we should be nonviolent. And yet, right, we, on the other hand, right, we know, for most of the Christian tradition, the magisterial Christian churches, and by that I mean, right, the Catholic Church, the Lutherans, the Methodists, et cetera, right, the different Protestant branches, right, the main ones, right, the mainline churches have not been pacifists. They have not renounced the use of force. In fact, many of them have explicitly rejected pacifism and called it nasty names. Just like, Stanley and John Howard would say, we were apostatizing. They would say, these old reformers would say the same things about the radical reformers. They were abandoning the faith of the tradition. And then, of course, you just have these kind of interesting facts, right? So not only have the churches not embraced nonviolence, most people who think of themselves as Christians line right up and enlist. And Catholics do it in kind of staggering numbers. 37% of the United States Naval Academy population is Catholic. All right, that's way more than the percentage of Catholics who are in the population. You'd expect it to be about 24%. It's actually much higher, right? We're even higher in terms of the U.S. military officer corps, right? Catholics sign up. Right, they enroll in the best military service academies. We have an archdiocese devoted to the care of soldiers, Catholic soldiers, right? The Archdiocese for Military Services. It's the largest archdiocese in the world, right? We are all in by our feet to the service, in defense of those who are attacked or vulnerable, however you want to describe them, and all in with the use of force. In fact, as you know, we even have a couple of saints in our past who were themselves soldiers. So there's, you got to kind of, on the one hand and on the other hand here, with regard to this question. There are alternative ways of looking at, I'm sorry for like the primitive, slide thing. It's not my bag, right? I'm not really good at it. I wish I could do graphics and music or something, but I can't, right? So how are we supposed to square this exhortation of us to be peacemakers with this apparent embrace of the use of force? One way to think of this, of course, is to think that peacemaking is simply incompatible with the use of force. If you are going to be a follower of Christ, if you are going to be call yourself a disciple of Christ, then you have to renounce the use of force. Okay, that's one possibility. That's obviously the possibility that Hauerwas and Yoder advocate. It's a possibility that's advocated by, you know, different faith communities in the Christian fold. The Amish, of course, are familiar, you know, famous for this. Mennonites as well. I'm going to, you know, show you a long passage from the Schleitheim Confession. Has anybody ever seen this before? Right? I mean, it's fascinating, right? The sword, by which they mean the use of force, right? The use of force is ordained ordained of God. It comes from God. They acknowledge that the use of force does in fact come from God, but it's outside the perfection of Christ. The community that thinks of itself within the perfection of Christ then, right, is excluded from using this sword, which is nonetheless ordained of God. It is of God. It's put in place to serve a particular function. The function is in bold there, right? That's a legitimate function of the sword. It's for the defense and the protection of the good. But we do not do this. We do not do this, right? Those of us who count ourselves in the perfection cannot do that. Okay? That is an alien work. It's a work alien to those of us who call ourselves disciples. We instead should only ban, right? We use the ban as counseled in the Gospel of Matthew. We do not use force. Force and peacemaking are incompatible. Correct? There are, however, alternatives to that view, and these would be that peacemaking is compatible with the use of force. And within this perspective, there are different ways to go. One is to think of force not inclusive of killing. We can use force up to, but not including, killing. Christians could be involved in the use of force, right, that is compatible with being a peacemaker, but we can never kill anybody. This could include some forms of pacifism. Sure, we can be involved in policing, for instance. We're willing to be involved in policing, but even policing would have to prescind from killing. We certainly could not be involved in war making. War making is a different kind of thing than the sort of domestic policing activity that might be acceptable. Or it could include a pacifism that is not even committed to policing, but it just recognizes there are some forms of the use of force which are acceptable, like diplomacy, like sanctions perhaps, but to embrace killing or using physical violence against somebody else would be contrary to what it means to be a Christian, right? So those would be certain kinds of pacifistic understandings. Another would be a form of just war account, okay? And this form of the just war account would say, yeah, we can use force, but we can never embrace killing if by that you understand, right, it as an intentional activity of ours. Instead, we would understand the killing that occurs in war as an unintentional side effect of our intending to defend those who are vulnerable to attack. So Christians are not intending to kill. They never in their heart would embrace, right, sort of the formation around killing that is associated with choosing to kill somebody. They'd instead be understand, we would understand them to be choosing to defend other people, a side effect of that defense which occurs in war to be killing. This is actually a real view. I mean, I'm not, you know, trying to mock it or anything like that, but this is a real view. It's an estimable position. It's a position of those who actually hold to the new natural law theory. We were discussing that earlier at dinner. There are some Catholics who they ascribe to something called the new natural law theory, and according to their theory of intentionality, the killing that occurs in war is unintentional killing. So it's not, we're now violating a commandment, right, not to kill. Okay, by embracing war, we are abiding that commandment not to kill. We never choose to kill. And if we can, we will choose methods of war making that will avoid killing as much as possible. But whatever killing does occur is permissible, understood as a side effect of our activity. And we can discuss that, or we can discuss it now, and we can also discuss it afterwards as well. Yeah, you had a question. Yeah.
Looking at this chart, I can't help remember. I think the circumstances were like somebody in the middle of a church in Texas stood up and I think started shooting people.
And yeah, this year, right? Are we talking about this year?
Well,
recently.
Within like the last month or two, very, very recently.
Yeah.
And then one person in the church got up. Well, I think there were six or eight, but one person got up.
It's Texas.
Shot the guy straight to death. And I realize that isn't a war, but I'm looking at the wording on the charts here, saying, well, is killing an unintentional side effect? Well, the guy who shot, I don't know, probably shot to kill.
Right. So he probably shot to kill. And that now you're like sort of thinking about sort of what was he thinking in his head, right? And so this is exactly like where that kind of question should be. What is the relationship of intentionality and action to what goes on in my mind or in my head, right? Like what are my thoughts? Can we leave that until, and we'll come back to it because it's an important question as you think about these kinds of issues regarding intentionality. What is the relationship of what's happening in my brain, right, or in my mind, to what is the intention of my act? It's a huge issue. You want to get in on this already? Or?
Yeah. I can kind of see where they're coming from.
Yeah.
But with the war on terror, this doesn't seem applicable because you can't hunt down terrorists who every day are trying, it's like, how is that not? It's one thing if you're defending a city and you shoot someone and you didn't want to. It's another if you're being proactive or doing a preemptive strike.
Yeah, yeah. So these are good questions. Let's get back to that one too, if you don't mind. I'm not like by any means kicking it. You're both asking versions of questions about the language of intentionality here, right? Or how can that language of intentionality capture these different kinds of acts? Okay. And I think it's important for us to return to that, both of these issues. They're big issues. They're issues I care a lot about. So that's the view that peacemaking is compatible with the use of force up to but not inclusive of killing, right? We can do lots of things. You could, maybe even hit people with things, but you can't kill them. You can take stuff from them. You can apprehend them and incarcerate them, perhaps, right? I mean, there's going to be different scales, but you can't kill them. The final version, the version that is the Catholic just war position, I think, this would be against the new natural law guys. They think I'm wrong about this, right? They think the Catholic just war position is the one right before this. I think it's this one, okay? So just to be full disclosure, okay, you can agree or disagree with me. Is that the use of force is compatible with peacemaking, okay? Inclusive even of killing, okay? According to this view, then, as I wrote, not all intentional killing is impermissible. We are sometimes permitted intentionally to kill other people. And therefore, the commandment not to kill, right, would best be understood as a commandment not to murder or not to, right, engage in impermissible killing. Okay, you can see that a lot of this is about act description for those of you who study philosophy or perhaps, certain kinds of like moral theology, right? This is really about how do we describe an act at this point or how do we classify something as killing or murderous, okay? In my judgment, the Catholic just war theory, which is really not a theory, right? The Catholic just war approach really is just tracking on Catholic moral theory in general. And all it's doing is specifying those situations when this kind of killing might be permissible. Okay, so the elaborate theory, which we'll discuss a little bit, really isn't a theory, right? It's just Catholic moral analysis in the context of the killing that takes place in war. And not even just the killing, all of the activity that takes place in war or any, you know, in any other violent enterprise or forceful enterprise, including policing, for instance. So this is not, as I said, an exception. It's not carving out an exception to the commandment. It's not like, okay, we're now saying the commandment applies in every circumstance but this one. Okay, we're saying, no, 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 the way to understand the commandment is the way Pope John Paul II puts it in Evangelium Vitae, number 57, which I have up here for you. I don't know if any of you guys has ever read The Gospel of Life by Pope John Paul II. Anybody ever read that? Except for, yeah. Okay, the professionals in the room. It's really interesting to look at, and it was the subject of much conversation when it came out, because here John Paul II is expressing, for those of you who kind of know the arc of his career as Pope, he comes to the United States early in his career, extraordinarily optimistic about the United States and sort of how it symbolizes respect for rights. By the time this comes out, he's a little bit more pessimistic about what he sees, because the rights language has been so stretched or attenuated that it's now seeming to justify abortion, right, and euthanasia and other things he's concerned about much more liberally than he had anticipated. So he writes this encyclical in the context of which he really rather vigorously defends a very specified conception of what the killing is that has been prohibited by the Catholic tradition. And this is it in a nutshell. And I put this whole quotation in here because some people think, in fact, he's raising it to a level of an infallible teaching by this language at the end of it. There's a little bit of a dispute about this. I'm not an ecclesiologist, but even ecclesiologists who are not inclined to think the church speaks infallibly are kind of saying, yeah, he appears to be signaling that here, right? So he confirms that the direct and voluntary killing of an innocent human being is always gravely immoral. Okay, so what is doing work in that sentence? Direct and voluntary. Okay, this is often collapsed into language of intentional. Okay, the intentional killing of, and then the second term that's doing a lot of work here is innocent. Okay, innocent human being. Okay, the direct and voluntary or intentional killing of an innocent human being is always gravely immoral. This doctrine, right, is reaffirmed by sacred scripture, transmitted by the tradition of the church, and taught by the ordinary and universal magisterium. If you look in that text, you will see he does this, he repeats this language multiple times and talks about his office. And it seems like he's saying this is this is the way the church understands this infallibly. So what do you learn from this? The church does not think it is always gravely immoral to intentionally take the life of non-innocent human beings, otherwise known as guilty human beings. Guilty of what? Raises all kinds of questions. But sometimes it may be permissible intentionally to take the life of guilty human beings. And we know, for instance, that for much, if not all, of her history, the Catholic Church has permitted capital punishment under certain circumstances. And we know as well that it has permitted Catholic participation in war and the use of force, even up to killing, that's associated with war making. Again, one way to explain that would be the way the new natural lawyers did and say we were just mistaken about the justification for that or what was going on there. Another way, it seems to me, is being suggested by Pope John Paul II here, and this leads to how the just war account proceeds. You almost all, I think, have some familiarity with this account already, that there are these two sort of banks of criteria that are really critical for thinking through these issues. The first one is the ad bellum, right, category of criteria. It has, right, there are many more criteria than this if you read different literature today. These are really the key ones. It has three fundamental criteria. These are the ones you find in St. Thomas Aquinas's account, why war is not always sinful, or whether war is already always sinful. And he says, no, it's not always sinful. And he talks about just cause, right intention, and competent or right authority. These are, I'm telling you or arguing for you guys, really just the way we think again about the morality of action. When I do anything, and anything that I do, right, I decide, let's say, for instance, to punish my 11-year-old, okay? He's high-spirited, right? He's active, and he does something that I've told him not to do. I decide to punish him. I ask myself these kinds of questions, right? Or they're operating, right? Moral, I don't ask. I mean, I'm not that sick, right? As a moral theologian, right? I don't actually sit down and write these out or ask myself, is there cause, right? But cause, right? The cause question is, what did he do? He did something. Let's say he smacked his 13-year-old sister, right? He hit his sister. He violated, right, her in some way, right? He hit her. That's a cause, right? What is my intentionality with this? What am I trying to do by punishing my child? Presumably I'm trying to reform his behavior, right? I'm trying to deter it in the future. I'm trying to create and form a young man who understands it's wrong to strike somebody else, and let's just assume it was a situation where it was wrong to strike his sister. Right, maybe he thought it was a just, you know, a striking of his sister. Just use of force against his older sister, right? But of course, he can't decide that. Why can't he decide that? Because he's not a competent authority, right? He's not a competent authority to make that decision. I, however, as the pater familias, as my wife is fond of saying, as she mocks me, right? I actually have that authority, or my wife has that authority as the parent, to make a judgment among the two of them, which of them is in the wrong, and to level punishment that is ordered by intentionality towards a good end. That's just how we act, right? And then the punishment, of course, the in bello concerns will be moderated by those. They'll be guided by that discrimination. I don't just start wailing everybody that I see. I've got six kids, right? They scatter, and I'm just blowing, right? Right, what is it, throwing fist? What do you guys say? Like throwing whatever, like whatever it is. Like something my kids say. So like, right, but I'm just hitting the right kid, or, of course, who would hit a child, right? I'm not, for the sake of argument, I'm not into corporal punishment. And my response is proportional to the offense that was committed by my son. That's the just war account, right? The just war account now is about that same kind of action guiding, right, analysis done by competent authority. Who is the competent authority in these cases? The Catholic account of this is wonderful, in fact, and it challenges certain presuppositions that some of us might have about the state's competency. Okay, so, and we can talk about that a little bit. I want to give us, you know, ample time to discuss these kinds of issues. But many people think, and Stanley is one of them, thinks that this involves a kind of Weberian conception of the monopoly by the state, right, over the use of force. That's not the Catholic account. What he thinks, I mean, I don't want to be like too jargonistic, what he thinks, what Stanley thinks, right, is that this conception of the use of force is a conception embedded in the nation-state system, which itself is, you know, a historic system. It didn't always prevail, and it's kind of flawed in many respects. I think the Catholic political analysis would agree with some of Stanley's criticisms of the nation-state system. Okay, it actually challenges certain ways the nation-state system spells this stuff out. So it's not simply right, that the United States government has, right, a monopoly on the use of force or is the right authority, even though it is in some respects. But its competence is challenged by other states as well. And it's challenged by regional agreements or international agreements that we, like, right, that find themselves embodied in international humanitarian law or in regional agreements among states in certain parts of the world. Right, this is real. That stuff is real, and that stuff is embedded long ago in the Catholic understanding of all of this stuff, finding expression in the modern era in thinkers like Suarez and Vitoria and so on. I can fill some of that out for you guys as well. But this is like more or less the bare bones of this account, okay? This kind of killing is sometimes permissible. It's unfortunate, right? It's a consequence of certain things that we reject about liberal political theology that Niebuhr was reacting against, that Stanley is reacting against. Human beings are sinful, right? Our existence is marked by sin. In time, we don't anticipate a kind of constant progression to the point where we expect human beings in society to live, you know, and to be able to live without force. That is guaranteed us not by our activity, right, but by Christ's activity. So long as we inhabit, right, the world in the way we do, we live in a world where sometimes, tragically, some human beings find themselves vulnerable to the exercise of power by other human beings. And this account explains those contexts in which it's appropriate as Christians for us to step in defense of those who find themselves vulnerable to attack, but in such a way, guided by these principles, that, right, we are trying to reform human community around, right, the principles of love. Intentionality, in my judgment, does a ton of work in this account, right? The intention is supposed to be peace, and that peace is not a kind of unreal conception of peace, but one that actually involves all of those who are party to conflicts, including those who are, you know, in the wrong, right? So that's why we respond to them in a limited way. It's why we respond to them without targeting their innocent populations, because we hope that after the conflict is over, we'll be able to live in a more peaceful situation that is inclusive of all of those people. Thank you very much. I'm open for questions or comments along any of these lines. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, you had a question before. Yeah.
And first, just thank you.
So oh, of course. My pleasure.
Oh, thank you. It strikes me that if the church determines that the use ad bellum is justified, especially as you mentioned, the intentionality aspect, then the use of bellum is negated in terms of words to demonstrate clemency after. You've already decided you want to kill someone, it's just silly to me. So I'm wondering why you think that it's important to still demonstrate proportionality if you're going to take their life, if the church has determined that they merited the ultimate punishment.
So we're not talking about a context of war there, right? We're talking about a context where we determine some individual is subject to punishment that might involve his or her death?
I meant in the context of an individual soldier. If a country, let's say.
So, maybe I'm not understanding the question. So, this is all of a piece, right? These are, don't think of these as like separable moments, right? Again, think of me or you, right, responding in a circumstance to something. Like, I use the example of mine. I mean, a sibling, right? A sibling wrongs you, okay? When you respond to them almost reflexively, because this is how practical reason works, right? If you're a well-formed person, practical reason, right, isn't sitting there going like, you know, right, like, you know, right, sort of like analyzing in time how to react, right? You're just going to react to the situation in some manner that is going to express all of this, right? It's going to express it all. You're going to respond to your sister or your brother or my son or whomever in a way that recognizes, you know, a wrong was done, tries to, you know, do something that is corrective, tries to do it in a manner that is proportionate and so on, right? In fact, it couldn't really be corrective if it was not proportionate, you know? Right? Do you understand? Like, if this is, no?
I don't
You don't understand, right?
I do understand what you're saying, but yeah. It seems you can't really demonstrate the force validity if you want to kill them. I don't care where the variability is within that.
Right, well, so we do this in the law, right? In the law, this is done. So like, if we're thinking about somebody who's going to be executed, right? We think about somebody who's going to be executed, and assuming, for the sake of argument, that the position on this is open to killing somebody, right? We ask all kinds of questions about whether this punishment, including execution, fits the crime, right? The soldier is asking, if you're talking about this, right, I mean, that's not alien to us, right? Is this punishment, right, does it merit death? Historically, as we know, people have been killed for stealing horses, right? And people thought that it was appropriate to kill somebody for stealing horses. Actually, there's a lot of great country music, right? You ever hear the song Redheaded Stranger by Willie Nelson, right? I mean, you know, you can't fault a man for shooting a woman who's trying to steal his horse. Right, it's proportionate is what he's claiming there. We don't think that's proportionate, right? Most of us would think that's completely disproportionate. You shouldn't be able to kill a woman just for, you know, stealing a man's horse, right? That's clearly disproportionate. The soldier in the context of war, right, his judgment about this is presumably, is my action right now responsive to what, you know, the seriousness of the situation I find myself in, right? So if the soldier in front of him throws his weapon down, he cannot kill him, either morally or in terms of the laws of war, right? That soldier who is otherwise vulnerable to being killed, once he decides to surrender himself and dispossess himself of his arms, it would be disproportionate killing, and it would be judged as such. Does that not?
I don't keep going into the answer. My last comment being that you don't kill someone unless you're acting preemptively, then you'd be acting as a result of their previous actions. It's a consequentialist killing.
You know, which one would be?
If you kill someone, even if they throw out their weapon, it doesn't change the fact, no matter what they did previously. So if you deem that they were guilty before, just whatever they do,
the difference here in terms of guilt, right, in war. This is a difficulty with the language of guilt in war, right? There's a different kind of guilt in war than there is in these other contexts. So if the woman in the Willie Nelson song, right, she's guilty. She did the act. She tried to take the horse. We can talk about whether it's proportionate or not, how to punish her, and so on, right? We're talking about her and a crime or an ostensible crime she may have committed. A soldier in the context of war, the language of guilt's problematic, right? It's a different kind of language at this point. It's an imputed guilt. He's not guilty of some, you know, sort of discrete act, right? No soldier asks the other soldier, what did you do, right? They just look at each other and they say, wait, you're wearing the uniform of the enemy. Therefore, right, according to the laws of war and according to this account, according to morality, etc., right, the claim is, you are guilty of helping prosecute or defend some wrong. That's it, right? It's not a judgment about anything you know that soldier may have done, right? It's a different kind of question. Yeah.
Hi. Yeah. So I have some questions, and actually I'm quite interested in how you linked sort of like your domestic analogy, like how you treat your son.
Yeah.
War, because there are many people, and I'm personally one of them, who sees a slight difference between these two contexts.
Yeah, good.
One of them being information. So I understand that when it comes to proportionality, you want to make sure that the punishment is sort of somewhat proportional to the end result, outcome.
That
also falls under intention.
Right.
But in war, the amount that you don't know about a particular situation is greatly amplified, to the point where even our best efforts to find out, you know, like whether or not this is going to be great, you know, like was that soldier actually guilty? Was he wearing the uniform or just a shirt that was that same color? You
for know, sure,
so many
for
things
sure.
That we don't know.
Right.
So in this case, how would we be able to apply these accounts?
Look, that's a great question, right? So the question is generally about the analogy, right? And there's a different kind of analogy, and you're right. It's actually called the domestic analogy. It's even better. The domestic analogy actually refers to the way force is used interstate, like inside a state, and then the way it's analogized from that to be used outside of the state, right? So now we've exited, right, the context of policing. We'll call it policing or judging and, you know, crime and law in a state. And now we're outside it. We're in that world that's often called in international relations of anarchy, right? The situation of anarchy. And it raises all kinds of questions. By what right can the U.S. government do anything to the people of Zimbabwe or France or China, right? It has authority there. It doesn't appear to have any authority external to it. Why, on what grounds does it do anything at all, right? So there's that kind of question. Then there's even a specified version of these, or like derivative versions of these questions of the sort you're asking. Here, right, you presume an entirely different context. In the family, like I said, it's right, there's an immediacy to it. Presumably there's greater knowledge and so on. Soldiers have very little knowledge about what's happening, correct? In what way could they be, you know, sort of cognitively aware of what they're asked to do and so on? That's a big problem for this account. It's not one that is not dealt with, but it's not clear how satisfying it might be to somebody like you. But essentially the answer is a version of tough luck. Right, there is not perfect knowledge. And even, like, I don't know if you've ever been punished by your parents, or if you have kids, right? You know, my son comes to me and says, or my daughter, I mean, it happens all the time. My daughter comes to me and says, you know, my son hit me. And then I get, you know, I start to get angry at my son. And he says, wait. I, you know, she did this first, right? And, you know, then you have this issue of, okay, well, how am I supposed to judge this, right? And I try to get as much facts as possible, and I make a judgment. Usually, of course, it's very quick. Right, and it's imperfect, and the same is true there. Everybody who thinks in these terms, and there are different views within even this world, will say, "Look, we get it. Soldiers don't have perfect knowledge. Nonetheless, they bear the burden of the use of force in conflict in a way even military leaders do not. They have the least perfect knowledge." We also know, on top of it, to add to it, you know, complicate this, is lying. There's misinformation, right? There's not merely, I don't know what's happening. There's also misinformation directed at soldiers and at populations that, you know, that also affects this account. But it's a great question that is explored in all this literature. You want to follow up?
Yeah, sorry. So yeah. I think I just have one more thing to guess about it, because I think I can quite understand the moral responsibility that comes with being a soldier and being involved in all these acts.
Right.
Whether or not you have as much information as you can.
Right.
Usually in those situations, diligence or finding out as much as you possibly reasonably can, that's enough. But I always thought that the challenge of our Catholic faith was that it's not just a relative kind of truth or relative information. There is an objective truth, or there is an answer of whether what we're doing is
right
or wrong.
Right.
So, yeah, so if you have two Catholic soldiers fighting for two different countries against each other, they both want to do the will of God, but they both understand so little about the situation. You know, I find it difficult for them both to believe correctly that they are right.
Right, and in fact, the claim would be that they can't do that. Every account like this, from the sort of classic accounts, and there are lots of them, will say there cannot be, for instance, two just causes, okay? Somebody is actually in the wrong. One side is actually in the wrong. Now look, the world is, right, the world is mixed justice at best, right? It's not like there's some, right, sort of righteous country, right, or righteous cause, right? All these causes are mixed. This is Augustine. You know, being filtered through Aquinas and later in the later tradition. But somebody actually had to have done something wrong. Somebody violated somebody else. Some army, for instance, crossed a border. Every time some army crosses a border, including Hitler's, right, they are going to say, we're doing it because of X. Here's why, right? We attacked the Sudetenland because there's a German-speaking population there, and it was improperly taken from us. Okay, it's an intelligible claim. Everybody understands it, but people will say, no, that's not really right. This was an improper action by a military, right? The Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia rightly is defending itself against this action, you know, and so on. There is a right here, even though the right is hard to understand, even though there's an intelligibility to alternative accounts being given. Soldiers, on the other hand, they don't know. Right, the Polish soldier and the typical German soldier, right? They don't know, or the Czech soldiers, right? They don't know any of this stuff. They're assuming what they're doing is right. The movie The Hidden Life, right, is in part about this problem. Are they morally culpable? Probably not, right? Probably not. But nonetheless, right, the guys who are on the wrong side, right, are going to be, you know, more like problematic than the guys who are on the side that's right, even though they just don't know. But we know knowledge is important to understanding whether somebody's in sin. It's all mucked up in conflict. I mean, it is. That's why war is tragic. This is what Augustine says, right? It's an evil. There's no question it's an evil. It's a consequence of human sinfulness, sin that affects our knowing, sin that affects our willing, right? And sin that affects the societies, you know, we find ourselves in. Yeah, it's tough stuff. It's good stuff. Let me get two over here, and then we'll come back to you because you asked the first question. In the front, yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask about, like, the inevitable death of innocence and whether or not it's a problem to this account. Because I think in practice, it's almost impossible to not kill innocents in war.
Right,
and I guess, like,
right.
I think especially, like, if I'm from the perspective of the quote-unquote competent authority, it
right.
seems like war has such a profound psychological effect on people that almost every time that we have a situation of warfare, we'll have an example of something like the My Lai Massacre, where even though the competent authority did not instruct this,
right.
when we stir people up into such a bloodlust to go in and kill other people,
right.
Inevitably things like sacks of cities happen, brutal massacres and rapes of innocents. So I think when you're looking from the perspective of the competent authority, this count seems like it would work if I was playing a video game where I could, like, control all my soldiers and make them only do good things. But it seems like when I thrust people into the context of war, how do I really ensure proportionality when war itself
or discrimination.
Has a psychological effect on people that makes it so proportionality and discrimination will kind of become out of my control?
Yeah, you just do your best, I guess. I mean, it's going to happen. Like you said, there's different ways innocent people will be killed. You're describing soldiers going rogue or situations where soldiers go rogue and intentionally kill others, right? The account would say, look, the best you can hope for here is to limit that as much as possible and punish it by law, right? So it would support international laws that seek to punish soldiers who do these things, right? And we know international laws can and have sometimes done that, right? They don't always do it, but it's inescapable. And then, of course, there's the other kind, right? I mean, there's at least two other kinds of killing of innocent that are associated with this. One would be when the competent authority does it itself, chooses to do it, right? So you described, you know, oh, the competent authority is, you know, kind of good in good faith, it's not gonna do it, and these guys go rogue. Well, what about when what about the hard cases of bombing of cities during the Second World War before the atomic weapons were used, right? Both sides determined that they were going to start bombing each other's civilian populations, right? The competent authorities made these arguments. It wasn't the soldiers, it was people in authority. And then it was the soldiers who had to go, oh my gosh, I guess I have to, right? I have to fly my planes over Dresden and start, you know, and unload my payload on top of those people. So you've got that kind. And then you've got the other kind, which would be the kind that is more often dealt with in the literature, which is the foreseeable side effects of good activity associated with war. As war gets bigger, or if war has always been involved in destruction of cities or in sacking cities, innocent people get hurt. How much of that is allowable by proportionality, even if you're not targeting it, but you just know, look, we know, if we sack this city, we're gonna starve the elderly and the young, right? And they're gonna die, we know it. It's a foreseeable side effect of our action. Or if we drop really good, well-targeted bombs on munitions, depots, and so on, we're still gonna kill people. You're gonna kill the guy in there with a broom, and you might, and probably, right, we can foresee we're gonna kill, you know, children. Who live nearby or something like that, right? Yeah, that's a consequence of this kind of activity. You know, that's why people hate war. That's why people are drawn to pacifism, right? It says, no, none of that. We won't have any of that. We won't be involved in any of it. right? But there's no getting around it. The great Methodist theologian Paul Ramsey said, "You look, war is not women roped off at jousting tournaments," right? I mean, he used the example of jousting tournaments. You use video games. Wars are fought among human beings, and human beings will be innocent and guilty human beings, or innocent and, I mean, guilty again is a weird term to use in this context, right? But innocent and non-innocent, that's why I used it earlier, non-innocent people will be killed. We know that. That's how wars go. Yeah, question.
Back to the war on terror thing from earlier.
Maybe
to refine it a little bit, I guess two pieces that are very common, because it's, I can see how this would work if it's like, okay, we're going to line our guys up, go. It's another if it's like they're hiding in a cave, go find them.
This one you can intentionally kill. You can intentionally kill. Yeah.
So
I can intentionally kill the bad guy.
Right. So what about, I guess, the two cases where I'm curious how to parse it out is one is preemptive strikes and the other is espionage. Because with espionage, you're intentionally lying. How does that, Augustine, I don't see how you can.
You couldn't do espionage. Or Augustine would say that espionage is sinful behavior. Right? I mean, one of the paradoxes for a lot of people, or the weird contradictions, right, for the Catholic account is you can kill people sometimes, but you can't lie sometimes, right? Right? I mean, it is. I mean, this always comes up in these contexts, right? A way to describe this all, of course, is what is sinful behavior here, right? This is the question Aquinas asks himself. Is it always sinful to kill somebody? Is it always sinful to wage war? And he says, sometimes it's not. Here is the circumscribed, situation where it's not. Is it always sinful to tell a lie? Yes, right? Yes. Can I lie in ambush? Yes, I can, according to Aquinas, right? Aquinas asks that question. Yes, I can. I can lie in ambush. But I cannot tell a lie, as you know, right? Augustine says you can't. If I lie, I am sinning. Sometimes the sin is really grave, right? Sometimes the sin, right? We have to remember this, right? Even though sinning's always... lying is always sinning, it's not always of equal gravity. Sometimes it's really grave. Sometimes it's much less grave. I'm not saying lie when it's much less grave. It's still sinful. It's still right. It's still vicious behavior. That question's always asked about, like, you're hiding Jews, right? You're hiding somebody who's being executed or in danger of being executed by somebody. Should I lie in that context, And the answer we all want to say is, of course, right? Of course you should. But this account says that's sinning, right? It's sinning. Unless you're going to, again, do an analysis, an act analysis, that modifies how you understand or what you understand a lie to be, right? And there's a way that's been done in our tradition that says, not everybody has a right to the truth, right? I mean, that's a classic way that you say, well, in that circumstance, when I say that, right, and maybe even in the circumstance of espionage, that person does not have the right to the truth there. I don't subscribe to that perspective, but some people in the Catholic community do. But these are all hard questions, right? War is like this, But it's good to know that when we're saying the church is not pacifistic or it's not opposed to war, right? We've got soldiers who are in, who are doing very interesting and, questionable stuff. And many of them are Catholic, right? And they're living double lives in some cases, right? They're telling lies not merely to bad guys, they're telling lies in some cases to their families. I ran into a guy, I heard a talk by a guy who's, served his entire professional life in the CIA as an undercover agent, and he said his parents died not knowing what he really did. Right? He was not Catholic. He was evangelical Christian, which is interesting. Right? But he his parents had no idea what he actually did for a living. You had your. I was going to follow up with him, but then I'll go to you guys. Yeah.
Just a couple of things for you to comment on. Before you're talking about the soldiers, maybe the foot soldiers didn't really know what's happening, and maybe listen, sort of, I'm paraphrasing, listen to the propaganda that really did think they were the good guys in this cause. But we could extend that. I think in a lot of cases, there's a good chance the people at the very top banning the war believe that they're right and that
sure.
they're the legitimate good. Okay, point two, which is a lot different. It could be you're fighting a war where the other side is doing absolutely atrocious things. And when your soldiers see that, they react to the other soldiers.
And do atrocious
things?
There's
a good chance they are going to do likewise. And,
yep.
And third point, which again is different from the other two, in World War II, at 7 a.m. on the day Pearl Harbor was attacked, this guy cracked the code, knew the Japanese were going to attack many, many hours before. I know this very well because my father told me the story several times. My father actually worked closely with that guy and knew him. From some of the other stuff I've been reading, all the people that died on Pearl Harbor Day may not have had to die. Our country might have let Japan attack Pearl Harbor so they would have an excuse to get into World War II just because they may have foreseen the consequences. Just a few things I'd be interested in your comments on.
I mean, I don't know what to say to any of them, to be honest. I mean, like, I think the first two seem right. I mean, those are always possibilities, right, in conflicts. I mean, it go to the point raised earlier about sort of how soldiers, anybody, right, not just soldiers, right, anybody can get sort of whipped up by not only, like, the hysteria or the propaganda around war, they also in the literature, we talk about the investment, right? Once you've invested lives and material into conflict, it's very hard to justify now stopping, right? Because wait, those guys just died, right? Young men and women just died and killed other people, right? So war takes on momentum that is very difficult to resist. I won't speak to the third point. I just don't know. I mean, I'm ignorant about that. Caesar.
So. You brought up earlier the example of the Dresden bombings,
yeah.
which
yeah.
You said you kind of know that it's kind of this. There's going to be collateral damage, right?
That wasn't even collateral. The decisions were made to strike sure. populations. Yeah.
Right. So the example that comes to mind is human shields. In the war on terror, so
yeah.
it's not uncommon that, and I'm maybe caricaturing it a little bit, but someone's on the CIA's most wanted list, you know, this guy is a bad guy, everyone, you know, top to bottom, the U.S. administration, government, throughout the military knows this and believes this, and they have the intelligence to back it up. He's got three wives, four children by each. Obviously, all the in-laws are there, the grandparents, everything, right? It's not unheard of for the American government to send a drone. I mean, we won't even deign to send a pilot there. Just send a drone.
Yeah.
Is that ever morally acceptable? If so, when is it not?
Right. So the argument. Right. So the argument there. Is that every time you ask a question like this, the United States, right, the response will be by the United States or others, like, look, we do our best to make sure those people are not present, right? In fact, we will not authorize a strike when we think that all those people will be present. We've become very good establishing the isolation of that person from as much of his or her family as is possible and so on, right? And whatever you're describing as occurring is a mistake. They happen, and they have happened, no doubt about it. But that morally and legally we are not justified to sort of tot up those family members. We're looking for situations where they won't be present. The old way, of course, this was done was just by getting some person in there, right, and trying to kill those guys, right? And the Israeli government, you know, is very good at this. The U.S. Used to do this more, like you said. We don't even send pilots in any longer. We send drones in to do these kinds of things. It's pretty clear, I think, that the proliferation of reliance on drones has loosened our own concerns about this a little bit, right? We've become overconfident about the technology. This is a danger of technology, is to become overconfident. In other words, a lot of these drone strikes seem really morally problematic to me. They are almost always on high value targets, right? That's where the language of proportionality, right, is that's the leverage for the language of proportionality. These are really bad guys, or guys that are involved in really bad actions. We've become over reliant on the technology, and the technology is allowing, like, sort of dulling our capacity to do moral analysis.
So, yeah, sorry. Just to follow up.
Yeah.
What you seem to be saying, and it's something I'm kind of sympathetic to, but maybe it's a little, it frightens the patriot in me.
Yeah.
That we're kind of saying, morally speaking at least, as Catholics, human shields are kind of a trump card. If this person is literally constantly in a compound with all 15 relatives, younger, older, same age, we're never morally justified. They can stay there and send out video after video, saying,
right,
exhorting, you know, people,
right,
saying, go attack those animals, you know,
right,
the Americans, go, you know, they're infidels, we need to annihilate them all. He's clearly got significant influence. He's a respected figure.
Yeah,
he's loyalist. Like, are we kind of saying, morally speaking, listen, you win.
The Catholic position, in my judgment, is sometimes there are situations you find yourselves in where you can't do anything, right? Where you actually can't act there. And that might be that kind of situation. An example of this, right? So the IDF, I was with some of those guys once, and they showed videos. And they're trying to show how respectful they are of non-combatant immunity is the language, right? It's also the language of discrimination. It's called distinction in international humanitarian law. We are not going to intentionally target innocent people. You can only, by international humanitarian law, intentionally target non-innocent people, like the bad guys you're describing, right? And so these guys showed video of this meeting of bad guys, right? And it might have been Lebanon. I can't remember where it was, right? But there's a meeting of really bad guys, okay? And I mean, we're stipulating that they're really bad guys, okay? I mean, we can talk about that too, right? And they show, there's children playing in the street, right? It's black and white, grainy video. There's children playing in the street. I don't know if you know where this is going or not, but the children are there for a reason, right? They're there for a reason. So as soon as a signal is made, one of the children gets up and walks to the door, and the guy who's, you know, coming out of the door picks up one of the children, and he walks across the street, right, and puts the child down until he's out of sight, right? And that's the children are there to literally be shields for these guys. And the IDF guys are showing this to us to say, look, we could have shot these guys anytime we wanted to, but we don't. Because these guys, and they'll say things like these monsters or these, you know, right, these bad guys, right, are literally using these children. They're putting these children in harm's way. They don't care. We care, right? The IDF is saying. And you know, look, I mean, there's a good book you should read, Rise and Kill First. Anybody heard of this book? It's about the activity of the Mossad and how this is actually a Talmudic saying. If someone should come to kill you in the morning, rise and kill first, right? I've bailed on the preemptive strike question, I think that was asked before, right? It's a preemptive strike justification. If you know somebody's coming to get you, you kill them, right? You don't wait, you rise and, you know, kill. The world is a nasty place position, right? And they're trying to show, look, we are operating with restraint. And what they will say is, all right, what we have to do is be really clever then. We've got to find those circumstances where we can take that guy, that guy who's going to use the kid, or the guy in your situation is surrounded by his extended family or whatever. We have to find a situation where that person is vulnerable and we can get just him. We're targeting only him because that's the only thing permissible by law. Will we permit some collateral damage? Of course, right? It's going to happen. But we can't just fire up, you know, a weapon into the, you know, the compound where that guy lives, saying, okay, you know, 16 outweighs one, right? You know, one really nasty, or 16 is outweighed by the bad, you know, the bad that this person will do, and so on. But that's what the stories that were told, even, right? I don't know what happens beyond that. Yeah. So